This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Everything in our world is constantly changing and more rapidly than ever before. People, businesses, products, and services all exist in a world that never stays the same. Think about the things that have come into your life that you thought were life-changing or made life more convenient. Things that appeared to be indispensable but have disappeared or are in the process of becoming less important. A few examples: Blockbuster Video, record stores, cable television, landline telephones, newspapers, the U.S. Postal Service. But things can also diminish in importance or have their existence become tenuous at best and somehow bounce back. And that's good to know because the world itself doesn't seem to be in great shape at the moment. The climate is out of whack and in need of bouncing back. So is the global economy. What may save us, what may help those with businesses in decline, is something called resilience thinking. What's that? We're about to find out. Our guest this hour, Andrew Zolli, wrote a book about it called Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. Mr. Zolli is a futurist and executive director and curator of PopTech, a leadership think tank which advises some of today's major companies. He's in town under the auspices of Foundation for the Carolinas and joins us for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte.
That's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
We were just talking off the air about how you live in Brooklyn, and in coffee shops around Brooklyn, people bring their IBM Selectrics instead of their computers to do work on.
That's right.
Bizarre.
Utterly bizarre. As the speed of technology change progresses, the speed of our nostalgia changes too.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that, I guess, too. Also with us in our Spirit Square studios, Brian Collier, Senior Vice President of Community Programs and Civic Leadership for Foundation of the Carolinas, which is obviously sponsoring Mr. Zolli's visit. Good to see you as well.
Good morning.
And I understand good news has made itself known this morning in the paper about you folks at the Foundation. You have a billion dollars in charitable assets.
Yep, it's great news for the Foundation, but I think it's even better news for the community. Shows that the community in many ways is bouncing back from 2007, 2008, and really I think this is a great opportunity to celebrate a milestone for the Foundation, but I'm much more proud of it for the community.
And for people who don't know what the Foundation for the Carolinas does, and how long you've been? I didn't know that you've been in existence for 55 years. I thought it was a relatively new invention. But what exactly do you do with that $1 billion?
Well, we are a community foundation, one of about 700 across the country. We're now the 12th largest in the country. We do a variety of things. We manage money on behalf of individuals, families, corporations, and other nonprofit organizations. But we also have our own grant making that we do in the community. And we also have what we call civic leadership, which civic leadership is how can we bring the convening power of the foundation, the grant-making power of the foundation, and the leverage opportunities in the community to address big community issues like veterans returning from Afghanistan and Iraq and education reform.
And the money comes from what source?
Right. Excuse me, a variety of sources. We have individuals who have put money in the foundation, people who have left their money once they've passed away have left it to the foundation for management. Just a variety of sources.
Are these big dollar donors primarily, or is it, can anybody be part of this?
Anybody can be a part of the Foundation for the Carolinas. And we try to – most people have the perception that it's all very wealthy individuals, but we try to find ways to make sure that everyone can participate in the things that we do.
Well, congratulations on the $1 billion.
Thank you.
To use, I'll take a loan. Let's begin with the subject at hand here with Andrew Zolli. You've been described, as I said in the beginning, as a futurist, part of an elite group of thought leaders. And I've seen other people who are futurists talk to other people who are futurists and people who are part of these think tanks. What do you do to become a futurist? What do you do to prepare for that? How do you begin to think about these big ideas about patterns and things and products and services that don't even exist yet? Or maybe just the kernel of it exists today?
Well, the great news is when you go to Futurist Academy on the day they give you your diploma, you can roll it up and smoke it. Whatever comes out in the cloud, that's what's going to happen. The reality is that what we do is spend a lot of time looking at emerging technologies and demographic patterns and economic and ecological patterns. And the goal really isn't, to forecast a specific future. It's not about seeing the future. It's about enabling communities, institutions, individuals to think about more than one possible future. So what are the most important forms of uncertainty for us to think about now? And let's think about multiple ways in which those futures might evolve over time.
But how do you learn? I'm curious about this. How do you learn to be someone who thinks that way so that you can help other people think that way?
Well, a really big part of the story is about building networks. So I run an organization that brings together scientists and technologists and engineers and designers, corporate and civic leaders, people working at the forefront of innovation in many different fields, and gets them to talk and think together. And that actually takes time because the world is organized largely into silos of excellence. The of excellence part matters a lot. You know, if you're working on an AIDS vaccine, you need to know what's been tried and what's been failed, what's failed, who's doing the best work. But if you can find people who are at the forward edge of each one of those silos and get them slowly to learn how to speak to each other and build a kind of horizontal connections between those fields, what emerges are really deep patterns. They're structural patterns of change. And those are the things that we encourage people to think about and ultimately act upon, because I think the best way to predict the future, as someone said, is to invent it.
Who invented resilience thinking? Where did that come from?
Well, we're in the midst of a huge conceptual transition. And it's a transition that's been happening over the course of the last 30 or 40 years, but especially in the last 10 to 15. It's a transition from thinking about the world as full of risks that we can mitigate. We're talking about climate change and economic dislocations and disruptions and other forms of volatility, to a period where we have to think about how to build our institutions, our communities, bolster their ability to weather the storm. It's essentially, can you steer, you know, if the storms become too big and the seas become too choppy to see past, the ability to forecast actually is diminished just by the inclemency of the weather. And so you have to build institutions that can withstand a lot of volatility. I'll put it in very personal terms. You know, I'm in my 40s. The first decade I owned as an adult was the 1990s. So let's remember the 1990s for a moment. It was a period in which the Soviet Union was collapsing. America was spending its peace dividend. The internet was ascendant. We thought all forms of competition in the future were going to be technological and creative. People were writing books like The End of History. It was like I just arrived at a party that was ending, and you know, it was over when I showed up. Now think about the decade that came right after that, the first decade of the 21st century. It's one that in many people's minds started with a terribly successful act of global terrorism, ended with a global financial crisis, and was stuffed in the middle with wars and ecological disasters. And I think in general stripped many people of their sense that we were really in control of the world. And so what you're starting to see is whether it's responding to disruptions like where I live in New York City, we've just had Hurricane Sandy. In 2012, not to make people feel bad, but in 2012 we had, just to pick a quick example, the largest drought in the last nearly the last 100 years in the United States. It plunged half the country into a state of federal emergency. We had the largest blackout in history that plunged almost 1 in 9 people on Earth, these are people living in India, mm-hmm. into the darkness. We had a heat wave up the eastern seaboard that literally melted the tarmac under airplanes at Ronald Reagan Airport in our nation's capital. And we ended the year with a huge megastorm in the most populated part of the country.
Yeah.
And so increasingly we have to think about, okay, how do we bolster the ability of communities to weather not just the economic crises, but the ecological crises, these other forms of things.
So are you saying that people have thrown up their hands on most of these complex problems that we face in the modern world today and said, okay, we can't fix them, so let's just figure out a way to deal with it and survive in spite of it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I would say it's actually – they're beginning to take them much more seriously because we're living in the age of consequences. There may have been a time in the past when we could have steered or clear of some of these disruptions, but the reality is now in a very overconnected world, disruptions in one system can cause disruptions in another in an instant. And so we have to take very seriously the consequences for vulnerable people. And one of the best things that community foundations like the Foundation for the Carolinas do and many others in the country is they knit together communities of civic leaders and community leaders who form the kind of – they form the real safety net underneath communities that are affected by these kinds of disorders.
Andrew Zolli is our guest. He's executive director and curator of PopTech and the author of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back, which is what we're talking about today on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. But at the same time, we face all these crises, and you're talking about this safety net provided by organizations like Foundation for the Carolinas. We have other people in our government trying to eliminate or diminish the social safety net that we've established over the past 80 years or so. Is that wise? Is that a way to be resilient? And they're doing it because they say we're out of money. We can't afford this anymore. Mm. We got to get rid of some of this stuff. Is that an example of resilience, of navigating through choppy waters by changing things or working your way around these problems as opposed to solving them?
If I could steer a middle course between those two options, I think there are plenty of ways in which we can make the safety nets we provide and the systems we provide to enable community resilience to be more agile. And in general, I think the argument that people who want to take those systems apart make is that they're simply not agile enough. One of the things we see in resilient systems is a lot of the resilience resides at the community level, at the local level. But it is vitally important that we bolster and support it at the right levels, that we encourage a safety net that is real and agile and responsive and can change. And I think there is a space in the middle there for a system that does take care of people, but is responsive and flexible and can change faster than the way we've normally been managing them.
Is that why Andrew Zolli is speaking at the Foundation for the Carolinas? This obviously fits in with your thinking over there.
Yeah, it was interesting that we've been doing a lot of work over the last several years, and we've never been able to name it.
Okay.
And then, you know, I mean, we call it civic leadership, but that is a hard thing to describe to the community, what it is, why we do it. And then when we saw Mr. Zolli's book and really read it, there were things that came out of there that we said, this is exactly what we've been doing for several years. We've been asking the community, what are the big issues? How can we tackle them? But how can we tackle them in ways that are different? One of the things that I found interesting about the book was this idea that resilience doesn't mean that the system goes into a cataclysmic opportunity and comes out exactly the same on the other end. Mm-hmm. It may change. It may adapt. It may be something better than what the system was before. And I think many of the things that we saw, I arrived in Charlotte in 2007. The city's trajectory was straight up. Got here, you know, 8 months later, started to feel a little tremblers in the community. And then we really started 2008, obviously traumatic time for the community. And instead of giving up or saying we can't tackle this, the community instead started saying, how can we be much more deliberate? How can we ask organizations to start collaborating? And I think one of the big things that we were talking about before the show is oftentimes foundations tell the community to collaborate, but don't do it themselves. And that's one of the things I think has been really enlightening.
And we'll talk more about that as we go through the program too. Brian Collier is Senior Vice President of the Foundation for the Carolinas, and Andrew Zolli is Executive Director of PopTech and the author of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and sitting in our Spirit Square studio, Andrew Zolli, Executive Director, Curator of PopTech, which is a think tank of futurists, I suppose, and the author of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. He is here under the auspices of Foundation for the Carolinas, and Brian Collier is Senior Vice President there for Community Programs and Civic Leadership. We're talking about resilience thinking. which is completely new to me. I knew nothing about this until you appeared on the horizon. Is it new to most people that you talk to? Is this book revelatory for lots of people?
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating. We see it is new in the sense that it helps frame a set of choices and decisions for people about how we think about bolstering communities and institutions and individuals. There's incredible new science about what makes individuals resilient and what makes communities resilient. But in many ways, it's also very old. This is a very ancient set of ideas. One of the things about resilience that's really fascinating is when you compare it to other ideas, like, for example, we've been talking about sustainability for a long time. You hear that word a lot. There are plenty of people – these words open up politically certain kinds of opportunities, and they close other ones down. So interestingly, when you test the word sustainability, for instance, with Americans, some of them think it's great, and some of them think it was invented by communists in Berkeley, California to get a certain set of policies enacted. When you ask people to reflect on resilience, what you hear very frequently is it's an American value.
Yes.
It goes way back in our culture. There are guys in cowboy hats with gun racks in Montana who don't see themselves as sustainable, but they see themselves as highly resilient.
You know,
that's a real shift.
Until the 20th century, life on Earth for human beings was not easy. And let's be honest.
Right.
I look back on this and sometimes and think, how did we get here? Because why aren't we all dead? Why didn't the species die out? I can't imagine living in that central heat and plumbing. And people did, and they did it in very harsh environments like Montana, where it's very cold in the wintertime in Montana in 1850 without central heat and no insulation in your house. Resilience is how we got here.
That's right. That's exactly right. And learning how to build reserves for when things go wrong and how to put the right kinds of insurance policies in place. In many ways, the progress that we've experienced in the last century, what you've seen disappear with all of that progress is a sense of how to be reliant and self-reliant when things go, go wrong in a significant way. And I think in many ways this we've been living in a kind of vacation from history. You know, that period is over. Now we are much more interconnected with the rest of the world. We're much more exposed to different forms of change, and we have to adapt.
Well, we don't know how to do anything. I mean, technology has allowed us to become interconnected. It's made our lives easier in many cases, not all. Better in many cases, not all. But nonetheless, it enables us to have this program on the air and talk to thousands and thousands and thousands of people in an instant. On the one hand, if this goes away, if the power goes out, we don't know how to do anything. All of our food is processed. It all comes from a freezer case in the supermarket or the produce case in the supermarket. It was delivered there by a big truck. We don't know how to do anything.
So let's think about that for that exact example. So and think about what happens in communities now where you're starting to see the return of urban food movements where people are doing urban farming and urban gardening. They're, instead of the folks who are thinking about this are thinking about it in the context of lowering the amount of miles traveled of their food and putting their hands in the soil and doing things that are good for the environment and produce better and more delicious things to eat. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you look at these kind of community gardening movements, one of the most important things that happens are the social networks that get reinforced as people in communities do things together. They get to know each other. And those kinds of social connections actually matter a lot. In places like New York City and where I live, we had a giant hurricane a few months ago. And in those communities that had strong civic institutions, there were people who knew where all of the little old ladies lived who weren't going to be – they weren't going to evacuate by themselves. They were going to sort of hunker down, or they might have been a little bit more isolated. So those kinds of activities, in addition to building local self-reliance and producing good things to eat and all the other things, are the kind of bolsters and enablers of the social fabric.
In the break, you were talking about the fabric of resilience, and one of the things you mentioned was these social networks, along with the right kind of leaders and trust – in the community and technology working and together with all of this. And we have done social, I've forgotten the name of it now, of course, but social surveys in this city, which tell us that trust and cross-pollination among socioeconomic groups is not very strong here.
Yeah,
we do a lot of things well, but we don't do that very well at the moment. We would be more resilient if we had done that.
Well, this is, by the way, that's true everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, you see over and over again communities that are on the path from me to we. They make a pit stop between from me to us, right? Which defines people who are not connected. And one of the things we found in a global – we went from the coral reefs of Palau to the back streets of Palestine to looking at New Orleans and Haiti and all of these places that had experienced these really terrible disruptions. And one of the things we found over and over again was in resilient communities, we found a certain kind of leader, and we call them translational leaders. They're leaders who we like to celebrate the person at the top of the organizational chart. We like – you know, leaders who point at the future and say, we're going that way. And we also in our culture like to celebrate the bottom-up activist who makes a lot of change at the street level. Mm-hmm. But actually, it turns out that a lot of the resilience of communities in particular, is a kind of middle-out leadership. And we don't talk about the middle folks unless we're making fun of them in Dilbert cartoons. You know,
it's, well, they're caught in the middle.
That's exactly right. But when you look at what happens when things go wrong, it's the people in the middle who are connecting sideways,
right,
not just up and down, but they're connecting across different communities and across different constituencies that can translate the needs of one group into the language and understanding of another group. They're where the resilience of the system really resides, because people who are at the bottom of the pyramid are affected. They're often traumatized and disrupted, and people at the top are disconnected.
Right.
So that mid-tier bolstering what we call these community leaders, these translational leaders, is hugely important.
This may not have anything to do with what you're talking about. I'm just making connections in my head. So just stamp me out if I'm completely off base here. When companies are trying to figure out what's right or what's wrong with a product or service or how the company is doing business, quite often they turn to the CEO to figure it all out. But in fact, it is the people on the factory floor, it is the people in middle management, the people who are talking to the customers, talking to the vendors, etc., who really know what's wrong. And they're not consulted most often because they're just middle managers.
That's right.
The head guy making $10 million is the one that's being consulted.
Yeah, often the most isolated person in the organization,
right,
is the person at the top.
So if this plays into what we're talking about, resilience, why don't we? We seem to be tamping down the middle class, diminishing their importance in all this. You're saying they're the most important ingredient.
Yes, absolutely. And when you find resilient organizations, what you find are what we call an empowered middle.
Mm-hmm.
And the empowerment of that middle is not just – they're not just organizationally empowered to do things, but to make new decisions. They have a much greater degree of autonomy than they typically have in a very hierarchical system. So they're much more empowered. But there's also an important thing. The thing that glues them together is a set of values. And you see this in the military. You see it in enterprises that have faced real disruption. It's the organization itself in the middle layer. When people who are not in charge but who hold the same set of values about what needs to get done are able to improvise without having to actually ask the people at the top for permission for every single thing they do, that's when you see a lot of resilience, because when something goes wrong, they're able to adjust and adapt and show a lot of flexibility.
We often hear that children are resilient, that they'll bounce back from terrible tragedies that shake their parents to the core. And we saw that in Sandy Springs Elementary. I'm sure that those kids will bounce back. We hope that they will. But some people don't bounce back. Some people are not resilient. Can we determine who is and who isn't, what kinds of organizations are and what kind of organizations are not?
So that's a great question. And there is here really amazing new science that's revealed what makes you more or less resilient in the face of a potentially traumatic event than the person sitting next to you on the bus or on the freeway. And the story is complex. So your social networks, the quality of your intimate relationships, like your familial relationships, your spousal relationships, your physical health, your genes, your access to resources, all those things play a part. But two things in particular play an enormous role in identifying your resilience. The first one is about your beliefs, how you see yourself in the world. Do you see yourself as having a lot of agency in the world, some influence over the world that you live in? And the second one has to do with your habits of mind. And here, a group of pioneering neuroscientists have begun to unlock the ways in which we can actually train people to bolster their psychosocial resilience. And I'll give you just one example. In Atlanta, a group of researchers at Emory University taught a group of foster children who were, by definition, children who'd experienced a lot of fragility, that experienced real vulnerability, so they were in stress. Compassion-based cognitive therapy, which is really, it's a contemplative practice that allows those children to better self-regulate their emotions. Now, two things happened as a result of this training. First of all, their psychological resilience to stress, as measured by various standardized tests, went through the roof. Their issues of recidivism and case management declined. But then there's a third and really fascinating point. In your body, one of the things your cells do, your physical cells, is you have something called the inflammatory response, which is not about retaining water. It's about your individual cells literally plump to protect themselves. And that system, the inflammatory system, can go haywire under stress. And there's a biomarker called the C-reactive protein in your blood, which is a good indicator of the level of cellular inflammation in your body. And high levels of the C-reactive protein are, over the long term, highly correlated with things like heart disease, cancer, diabetes, things that have enormous social cost to all of us as a society. And what the researchers at Emory found was that these children's psychological resilience skyrocketed and their C-reactive proteins plummeted, which meant you were helping them psychologically in the near term and you were helping them physiologically in the long term.
So what did they do to make that happen? What precisely did they do?
So most of us, when we think about our emotions, I'll just talk about myself. I'm a very coming across on the radio as a very placid, normal guy until you cut me off on the highway, at which point I become a homicidal maniac. And I'm glad none of that is on the public record, the things I say.
You're a New Yorker.
Right, exactly. So most of us think about our emotions as a kind of stimulus response system. Something happens to us and we respond emotionally. Something nice happens, we respond positively. Something negative happens, we respond negatively. Mm-hmm. These researchers and neuroscientists think about emotions slightly differently, which is that you can imagine like you have a tank, a reserve of emotional response. When you spend that reserve, especially in high stress environments, very quickly down to nothing, mm-hmm. that's when real damage happens to people's psyches and to their physiologies. So by training people to attend to their emotional response in real time, and we're talking here about soldiers. This is being done right now with soldiers. It's being done with first responders, with emergency room physicians, people who are in regularly high-stress environments. By giving them very specific forms of cognitive training, these are secular. They were actually rooted originally. They were discovered in Buddhist traditions, but I'm talking about secularized, sanitized, non-religious, mm-hmm. contemplative mm-hmm. practice in real time. It allows people to be much more judicious with the way in which they spend their emotions in the instead of simply becoming a homicidal maniac when the guy cuts me off on the highway, I decide to become a homicidal maniac. That is, or not. That is, I decide the scope of my emotional response. And with people who know that they're in high stress environments, it allows them to reduce their emotional and stress reactions.
Because they put themselves in control?
Yes.
They decide how much they're going to react?
That's right, because they're able in many ways to have very specific forms of mental practice, and it takes time to learn.
Andrew Zolli is our guest, author of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. You talk in the book about belief systems conferring advantage, and you're talking a little bit about this right now, belief systems conferring advantage at times of crisis and habits of mind. There's a difference between the two of those things, right? And the belief system does not have to be based in religion, but it can be.
That's right. You can think about it more as a kind of personal cosmology. So there's a branch of social science research called, which is really wonderful, it's called hardiness research. And it studies people who have some innate immunity to stressful circumstances. And researchers in this field have discovered that people who hold a certain set of beliefs about the world tend to be more psychologically resilient than people who don't. And those beliefs include things like, if you believe the world is a meaningful place, if you believe that you have agency in that world, and if you believe that successes and failures are placed in your path to teach you rather than being kind of capricious, you know, acts of a random world, then you tend to be more psychologically resilient than people who don't hold those beliefs. And this is one reason why some researchers in the field believe that systems of faith, regardless of their content, that faithfulness, that spiritual practice has been such a sticky thing in human history, in the long arc of human history, because those are the kinds of things you have to believe to have a spiritual tradition. So that is to say, they're the kind, they're not, one doesn't cause the other, but they're strongly connected.
Mm-hmm. How does this translate to organizations?
Well, I think the place it translates to organizations most directly is in the connections to values. So we're not, you know, obviously to work at any institution, including WFAE, you don't have to be a member of a particular, you know, spiritual worldview or the like. But there are certain kinds of things in many institutions that form the kind of core values of the institutions. Right. And when people connect with those values, values are a form of belief. We say these things, we believe these things are really important. In the Navy, just to pick a very hidebound traditional organization, on an aircraft carrier, one of the things that on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier is anybody can stop all activity on the boat with the push of a button. Any 19-year-old can stop all activity. If they push that button wrong, there's no downside. There's no penalty.
So it's important for them to know what they're doing and to understand what's going on in the organization. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Andrew Zolli is our guest. He's here under the auspices of the Foundation for the Carolinas. He's written the book called Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. He's a futurist, a member of a think tank, or the creator of a think tank called PopTech. Brian Collier is Senior Vice President for Foundation for the Carolinas. You spend time in your book addressing what is one of the most intricate systems to have failed in recent years, and that is the global financial system. And the crisis was created by some very bad decisions that were made and also by people perpetuating something that was like a house of cards, but they had to keep it going because if they didn't keep it going, they knew it was going to collapse. But if they could just keep it going, everything would be going on as it always had. And you say that finding a solution to preventing such a thing from happening again can actually be found in nature. And you talk about coral reefs, of all things.
Yeah, that's
explain
right.
that.
So when we look at big complex systems like the global financial system, one of the fascinating things about the financial system and all complex systems is that they have a series of set of dimensions which tend to be consistent across them, whether you're talking about an ecological system, a financial system. One of those dimensions has to do with complexity. So in a complex system, you can imagine a kind of a seesaw, right? At one end of the seesaw, a continuum of ways to organize a system like a financial system. Mm-hmm. At one end, you have people who are – you have very, very efficient but very fragile arrangements. At the other end, you have not very efficient but very robust arrangements. Mm-hmm. And in an effort to get the benefits of the efficiency without the dangers of the fragility, right, because many systems, when they achieve a peak efficiency, they're actually in their greatest danger, because to get peak efficiency, you actually have to take out all the insurance systems, all the brakes. You want a car to go really fast, don't carry the cost of brakes. Just let it slow down naturally by itself, right? So we take all that stuff out of the system. But that is the moment we're in the greatest danger. Now, so in an effort to balance the benefits of efficiency and the benefits of robustness, we build these complex systems that are complex regulatory systems and complex products. And what you saw was a lot of bad decisions in the global financial crisis, no question. But you also saw enormous systemic complexity. And the complexity, as much as anything else, destroyed the system and continues, actually, right, to have bad consequences. You know, we heard a lot about people securitizing mortgages and creating these things called CDOs. Some of the contracts that were produced by computers for some of these financial products were a million pages long. Literally, a million. It would take you something like a century reading at normal human speed to get through a single contract. So no one could possibly have read them. And people digested all that complexity sort of whole cloth. So one of the fascinating things that we see is and that researchers are beginning to look at is how to take the self-regulatory systems of natural systems and begin to apply them to the kind of synthetic systems like our economic system. So just before the crash, a group of ecologists were hired by our Federal Reserve to look at the financial transfer network that backs up all the banks. And they wrote a paper on it called Ecology for Bankers, mm-hmm, in which they looked at the lessons that you could take from things like coral reefs. One of the things that coral reefs have is they have these species if you've ever been diving or you go on vacation, you see, or to the aquarium, you'll see this riot of beautiful, colorful fish. Most of those fish don't do very much except eat the coral, or they eat one another, they eat algae. But there's one kind of fish on a reef that does something really interesting. Reefs have a system which is very beautiful, and it's the what we call the coral-dominated state, where there's lots of different fish and lots of biodiversity. And there's algae on the reef that provides food for the fish. But if the algae grows out of control, the system can tip over into collapse. Mm-hmm. So there's one kind of fish called a pinnate batfish. And what that fish does is it, as the algae begins to grow, it changes its behavior. It goes from eating coral to eating this very particular kind of algae that can tip the system over, and works as a kind of built-in brake on flipping the system from one state to the other. And there are global financial regulators, people who are working on the whole system, the international financial system, who are working to build policies that do exactly the same thing based on what they've seen these fish do in reefs.
This is where your book gets really complex, because going through my mind are all these things that you talk about, and I don't know where to begin, quite honestly, because you talk about when you put in safety systems. Sometimes the safety systems themselves I don't know how to explain this. They are so complex that they get in the way of what they're designed to do.
That's right. Yeah.
And they're designed to fix things that we can anticipate happening. So when something happens that we don't anticipate happening, it can bewilder the people who have to deal with this in an instant. They can't deal with it.
Absolutely. And the place you see it in, a really common place you see it outside of the financial system, is in airplane crashes. So, there was a recent, mm-hmm, terrible plane crash, Flight 447, that went from South America to – it was an Air France flight. And it, like many other of these crashes, was ultimately blamed on human pilots. But in fact, what happened was you look at these poor pilots, when you look at the voice cockpit recorder, they're utterly bewildered by the signals they're getting, because some of the signals are out of date. Some of the signals are telling them contradictory information. Mm-hmm. And sorting through all of that in about 15 seconds to figure out what's actually going on is an impossible cognitive task. And the reality is most of the signals were the safety systems giving them contradictory information. So sometimes safety systems don't actually make us safer. They actually make it harder to regulate. Interestingly, we've just passed a lot of financial reform. And if you talk to the board members of the banks, we're talking about the people who oversee these financial institutions, they'll tell you that the regulations that we've added already make the system almost harder to regulate, because they have too much information. They get too much detail, and it's hard to see what's actually going on.
We can't go back to Glass-Steagall? I mean, this all happened when we repealed Glass-Steagall. So if we just went back, we just turned the clock back, put those things back into place, would we be in a better place? Can you put the genie back in the bottle?
Well, I'll tell you, my personal belief is that the world needs a much more vanilla system. One of the most important paths to resilience is the path through simplicity, is reducing systemic complexity. I think there is a kind of bargain that because we're not about to see the repeal of Glass-Steagall anytime soon, there is a bargain for the folks on both sides of this issue. And that bargain is to trade fewer regulations for more systemic simplicity. That is, you make the system simpler and we'll take the rules off, because a simpler system needs fewer regulations.
But you talk about how when we diagnosed the problem, these derivatives that got us into a lot of trouble were so complex that people didn't know what they were selling, didn't know what they were buying, they didn't know who they were buying it from, they didn't know who they were selling it to. And then you talk about the 20, I think it was 25 banks in the center of all this.
That's right.
That are so interconnected that they're like one bank.
Yes, they are. Half of all assets in the United States are in the hands of five private
entities. So if one bank goes off the cliff, they're all interconnected. They're all going off the cliff.
That's right. That's why, actually, it isn't that any of them are too big to fail. It's that they're too interconnected to fail. And that's not changed since 2000.
And how many other systems in the world are like that? There are climate systems that are like that. It's not just the banking system.
Well, that's exactly the world we live in. The world we live in is that connecting that overconnected system of financial institutions and other corporations and other institutions they're connected in a subterranean way to the climate system, to the energy system, the food system.
So this interconnectedness that we love to talk about and brag about
has a downside.
It has a downside. It's a serious downside.
Yeah.
It's unmanageable.
In the 1990s, when everyone discovered chaos theory and complexity theory, they liked to talk about how a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the planet could create a hurricane on the other side.
True.
Now we're terrified of the butterflies. Yeah. That is to say, little tiny triggers lead to huge disruptions, and that's the world we're living in. A great example of this, just a tiny example. We all saw the Arab Spring that happened, initiated a year and change ago. Well, it was triggered in Tunisia by a fruit seller who was being harassed by a police officer and had sort of had it. And what was interesting is just before that had occurred, there were a series of protests over skyrocketing food prices. So what you saw was the connection between the food system in that particular case and the political system. The political system was a tiny little match, little tiny match, and the tinder was there for a huge social transformation of the whole region.
Of course, we think of that as being a 21st century problem, but the same could be said of the start of World War I. Couldn't it?
Absolutely. We live essentially in that World War I, someone's killing the Kaiser kind of craziness, where the number of dependencies between systems is so great that it's unmappable and it makes forecasting virtually impossible. And in that context, what do you do strategically? What you do is you make sure you bolster the resilience of your region, your community, your household.
So my reaction to that would be, let's all go live in silos. Let's not talk to anybody. Let's just be self-sufficient. Let's be resilient unto ourselves. And to heck with you, I'll just be me. You say that's not the answer. And you say that the answer is greater diversity. And not am I on the same planet?
That's absolutely right. You can sort of think about it like a continuum, right? If we are too densely overconnected, we get the kinds of rapidly spreading contagion and disruptions. On the other hand, you and your bunker are actually far less resilient than if you are working cooperatively with your neighbors, if you're deeply connected to your community. And if you're connected to people who think differently from you, that's why diversity is important. It's not just that it's sociologically important for you to be connected to people who don't look like you or who don't come from the same traditions you do, but it's important that we get the right kind of cognitive diversity in a system. The resilience of a system is predicated on the ability of a community to think about different things in different ways and people to be connected. There is a kind of Goldilocks zone in the middle, and that's really what you want. You don't want to be too isolated, but you don't want to be overly connected. You don't need to be connected to everybody, but you need to be – some connection is really important.
Does this take it back to what you were talking about a little while ago, Brian, about getting through this tough time in the city at large and in the Foundation for the Carolinas particularly through collaboration?
Yeah, and I think that the collaboration has changed over the last couple of years, where before it was a group of people who all knew each other, who lived in these individual silos, getting together, talking. I think one of the things that we've really been focused on at the foundation is how do we get diverse voices in the room? So a thing like Project Lift, our education reform effort around West Charlotte High School, instead of the foundations coming up with a plan and going over there and doing to that community, we actually went over, had community engagement, listened to the kids, listened to the parents, and every step along the way it has been made with their voice at the table. And I think that's the kind of connectedness that changes the paradigm for the community, because it's not just connected foundations making decisions. It's the community being involved in that process.
Resilience, the topic today with Andrew Zolli and Brian Collier here on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. You don't use the word resilience, Brian, when you talk about it, but that's what this is, right?
I think I will now. It's one of those words that you – it's one of those things as you're doing it, you know there's got to be a word for it, and it's such an obvious word that once we read the book, we thought, gosh, this is – that in the translational leader definition, those are just two things that I honed in the moment we started reading the book.
So how do you make an organization think this way? How do you make it more resilient? How do you teach them about cognitive diversity and what it takes and – how do you make that happen?
Well, there are a million recipes, and I think it's important to remember that resilience is an art and not a science. It's rooted in creative processes and improvisational processes. It's rooted in our connections to one another. There are new technologies that can help us better sense and detect when changes are emerging in a system that help us respond and coordinate our response in more interesting and important ways. So there isn't a single answer. But I'll give you one particular example where we found a lot of amazing resilience and cultural change was in the U.S. military. At Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, there's a fantastic place called Red Team University. Mm-hmm. It was started by a guy who was the first tank commander at the tip of the spear going in the first Iraq Gulf War, and a guy who had been on the ground in Bosnia. And what he realized was that the U.S. military, which sees itself as the department of breaking things and blowing things up, was now charged with keeping the peace, and in that context had to have much better cultural understanding of the people that it was interacting with, and not just the communities that it was interacting with, but the press and their colleagues and their collaborators and all of the other actors in the field. So they started this place that actually teaches a kind of – it's a school for skeptics in the U.S. military chain of command who work with commanders who are developing plans and look over their shoulders and say, well, have you thought about this? And what about this? Now, that doesn't mean they want them to change their plans necessarily, but they want them to think about some counterfactuals while they're doing that kind of planning to increase their cognitive diversity.
That must be very difficult for the people being the naysayers, because people don't like naysayers in those organizations.
Yeah, I'll tell you, actually, you know, it was really funny that one of the days we were there, we were watching these lieutenant commanders, and these are really, like, you see V-shouldered men and women. I mean, they're just yoked people, watching scenes from The Godfather. So they were watching the consigliere, this character named Tom, report bad news up the chain and how they did that without breaking the cohesion.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic in 5 seconds or less?
I'm optimistic.
Okay. Another show will be about why, given what we've talked about today.
Yeah, right.
Andrew Zolli of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back. He's the author of that. Brian Collier, Senior Vice President for Foundation for the Carolinas, who brought him to town. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.